Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archives.
We're interrupting programmes to make the following announcement.
Well, actually, this is Jonathan Marks kicking off this week's Communications Magazine from Radio Netherlands with a theory. If you've ever searched between the shortwave broadcast bands, you may have come across strange stations shouting out numbers or letters. The languages vary, but the monotonous tone of what are presumed to be spy stations is consistent.
India, Bravo, Kilo, India, Sierra, Foxtrot.
That's what they sound like. Now, last weekend, strolling along the seafront at the British seaside holiday resort of Blackpool, I think I discovered the place where all those mechanical voices are trained. Outside vast amusement halls packed with middle-aged housewives, the familiar tones drifted on the breeze.
Eyes down, off we go. White 72, 72, white 72, you first. Blue 60, blind 60. White 67, 67. Yellow 27, 27. White 76, 76. Blue 47, 47.
Hello, tape recorders and pirate radio stations.
You're listening to Media Network.
Welcome to our seaside special. And seen from a foreign perspective, a day out at Blackpool on the northwest coast of the British mainland is something hard to duplicate in any other European country. At this time of year, blustery westerly gales off the Irish Sea are common, and so to extend the holiday season, Blackpool has strung up 5 miles of coloured electric lights to make the seafront look like Las Vegas. You can shelter from the wind by playing bingo, trying new video games, or climbing the 158-metre-tall Blackpool Tower. Fish and chip shops close as late as 1 o'clock in the morning, which gives you plenty of time to visit the souvenir shops to pick out a T-shirt with a suggestive or usually obscene slogan on the front of it. But Blackpool also has its charms, the friendly people, and interesting buildings like the Winter Gardens Conference Centre. Last Saturday, whilst the British Liberal Democrats gathered downstairs to discuss their future, including even their official party title, about 550 radio enthusiasts from around Europe convened in the Spanish ballroom upstairs for an international radio conference. It was entitled Communicate 88, mainly the result of hard work by Ruth and Barry Johnston and Gary Hogg of the Blackpool-based Anorax UK organisation. For this was a meeting of radio enthusiasts whose interests range from offshore broadcasting through pirate radio, especially of the Irish variety, right through to legal international broadcasting stations such as Radio Netherlands. Curiosity as to the scope of the event persuaded me to take the ferry across to Britain to investigate for Media Network. And not only did we get a hearty welcome and useful listener feedback to this show, but there were a host of interesting guest speakers.
Laser is back. It's new. It's improved. It's better than ever before. Program details will be announced soon. Go tell a friend.
You may remember the saga of Laser 558, a pop music ship that broadcast from the North Sea a few years back. The MV Communicator vessel is still moored on a river in the east of England, with normally 2 people guarding the equipment from souvenir hunters. The manager at one time was American John Catlett. He's now a consultant to the Radio Tara Longwave project. In Ireland, at a place called Clarkstown in County Meath, protesters have just been ordered off the site where Radio Tara wants to build its transmitter site. It plans to broadcast to Britain on 254 kHz longwave. John Catlett gave me the background.
It's been slow to develop at first because we've encountered some resistance on the part of local people in the neighborhood of where our antenna is going to be. It's a very tall tower, and I can understand I personally would be less than thrilled if it were being built in my backyard.
How tall is it?
It's 815 feet high.
And what's going to be the format of the station?
It's hard to be very specific about it at this point, except that we are anxious to attract a substantial audience. And so it will be music-based and popular music-based. We hope we have some tricks up our sleeves.
Outside the Blackpool Conference Centre, the BBC had put up many posters advertising the fact that its national pop music network, Radio 1, has found a new band. After years of talking, Medium Wave is on the way out.
Here's what's happening at Radio 1.
The Radio 1 FM service, ultimately planned to cover the country. It started in London. On 1st September, it opens in central Scotland, the north of England and the Midlands. On 30th September, you'll find us in South Wales and parts of the southwest. And in November, it reaches out to Belfast and Oxford. And by June next year, we'll be heard in most of the southeast. Like the railways, we're getting there as fast as the FM frequencies become available. If you're not being served yet, please be patient, because we're going as fast as we can.
Like the railways.
Radio 1 FM. Oh, goodness gracious, this is the age of the FM stereo transmitter, you see.
So, isn't John Catlett of Radio Tara facing a losing battle by wanting to start a pop music station on Longwave?
It is an unusual development. In the United States, as you know, the FM band is totally dominant for the music medium, and the Longwave band is unknown. But in the UK, they are familiar with the fact that Longwave exists. It's available on most car radios, and we hope that a younger audience will discover that there's programming aimed for them on the Longwave band as well.
And now by when? I mean, you're obviously just starting construction, but you've got to start promotion, I guess.
We are unwilling yet to announce a date, but we hope to begin to select the staff early in 1989 and be on the air, I should hope, before too many months into the year.
And who's behind it? Is it a joint project?
Yes, it's a joint project between the Irish government's RTE and Radio Luxembourg.
But Luxembourg's been aiming English programmes on medium wave towards Britain for decades. Isn't its involvement in Radio Tara a sort of conflict of interests?
I think it's perhaps not a conflict of interest, but a logical joining of efforts, because Radio Luxembourg only operates at night, and Tara will be essentially a station delivering a signal in the daytime. We think that at night the Tara signal will be impeded by an adjacent channel station in Africa. We're not quite sure by how much, but we hope that people will listen to us, and then in the evening perhaps listen to Luxembourg.
And what's the power you're planning?
500,000 watts.
Is it fair to draw a comparison between what was Laser 558 from the North Sea, never more than a minute away from music, and the Radio Tara project of the future, or are they completely different ideas?
I don't think it will be possible to identify one from the other. The only common link at the moment is myself.
Persuading the FM-orientated youth to discover other parts of the radio dial is something that's being discussed in the United States at the moment. While Communicate 88 was being prepared, the National Association of Broadcasters were meeting in Washington, D.C. I tried to see a sample of their new super radio, designed to revolutionise the market, it was claimed. But after three postponements, I gave up. Lou Josephs of Boston, though, persevered and kept asking the NAB where were the results of their $50,000 super radio project. So, Lou, let's have a quick update.
Well, they told the disappointed crowd at least another 10 hours was needed to finish the AM circuits, and the radio was supposed to be operational by sometime Saturday, the last day of the convention. And now they're telling people that it'll be at least a couple of weeks before the ultimate radio is workable, on AM at least. It does work on FM. The designer told me that the delay could even be longer, and he says basically it's going to be ready when it's ready.
But you were able to see the radio sitting on the table, so what's different about its appearance compared to an ordinary set?
Well, the first thing that you're going to notice is there's this big breathing space on the top of the radio, and in the cabinetry you're going to find a plastic loop antenna for AM reception. The second big difference is you'll find a 10 kilohertz filter for AM reception. The third difference is that the radio continuously tunes from the top end of the AM dial right down to the FM dial.
So what happens then when you get to about 1700 kilohertz, the top of the AM broadcasting band?
The radio automatically switches you to the bottom of the FM broadcast band.
And why have they done that?
The idea being it's a potential savior for AM because a good part of the baby boom audience has never discovered the fact that AM exists, but they know about FM.
So by making one band out of the whole thing, then people will tune from left to right.
Yeah, the theory here obviously appears that radio is radio.
And that's just what Radio Tara in Ireland needs. The NAB's tabletop super radio, by the way, doesn't have synchronous detection, which surprised some engineers. Several Blackpool Conference delegates reminded me that tomorrow is the last day that many of the shortwave transmitters carrying the US Armed Forces Radio and Television Service will be heard. As from October the 1st, AFRTS transmissions from Voice of America transmitters in Bethany, Ohio and Delano, California, USA will cease, along with a relay via Munich, West Germany. Melvin Russell is Assistant Director of AFRTS in Washington, D.C., and explained that there are three reasons for discontinuing the service.
One is that the quality of the service for shortwave is marginal at best for the audience that we're trying to serve, which are U.S. military personnel and their family members that are stationed outside the United States. Two is the coverage that we get from the transmitters that we lease do not in fact cover the locations where we have a number of military personnel. For example, in the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, and in parts of Europe and the Far East, Antarctica, for example. Third, the cost of the leased transmitters has continued to rise over the last few years as our audience has dwindled for shortwave. And because technology now has allowed us to go to a high-quality satellite delivery system to reach our Navy ships at sea and our remote land areas, we've chosen now to take advantage of this.
For a third of the cost of shortwave, AFRTS will hire a channel on the Inmarsat satellite system starting on the 1st of November for the Pacific area and on the 1st of March next year for the Atlantic. This will allow high-quality audio to US Navy ships at sea. Satellites are already being used to feed material to large US military bases in Europe through AFN in Frankfurt and the Far East Network in Tokyo. AFRTS has a loyal shortwave following, though, especially amongst American civilians abroad. The Voice of America, after all, isn't chartered to serve Americans. So will they say goodbye tomorrow?
Oh, yes, we definitely will. Before we sign off for that day, we will certainly come on and say goodbye. We've been on the air for a very long time. We know that we have a large number of listeners around the world that listen to shortwave, either our service, the Voice of America, BBC, and various other shortwave services. And, of course, we will say goodbye.
Once again, the final score, Chicago Bears 28, Miami Dolphins 7. Now, this is Rick Crawford, hoping you enjoy the broadcast and reminding you that this has been a presentation of AFRTS Sports. This is the Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
But, Mr. Russell, you won't go off shortwave completely because I believe there's an armed forces station in Antarctica which uses a 49-meter band channel to reach people off the base. That surely isn't going to go off the air?
That will not close. They will continue that. But, in fact, they will have a higher quality service because we are putting a satellite dish on Antarctic to receive the service that we're providing. But that small station will stay on the air.
And Arthur Cushion reports that AFRTS Antarctica is being heard in the Pacific at the moment on 6012 kilohertz at 08 hours UTC until the channel is blocked at 09 hours. If you want to contact AFRTS to comment either way on the demise of their shortwave operation, they do have an address, and it's 601 North Fairfax Street, Suite 360, Alexandria, Virginia, zip code 22314, USA.
Media Network's Blackpool Illuminations.
Right, we're going to have our first little chat and interview. I still don't know if the coach has arrived. I don't know if anybody's given any indications that he has, so it's probably still stuck on the motorway. But
milling around the display tables at the back of the conference hall, I picked up two stories concerning offshore broadcasting. Gary Hogg alerted me to the news that a Greek vessel is currently being fitted out with a 10-kilowatt medium wave transmitter and an antenna at Haifa in the Mediterranean. A religious organisation called Gush Amunin appears to be planning to broadcast off the Israeli coast after being refused airtime on land-based legal stations. And in the last couple of weeks, the good ship Sarah has finally slipped out of Boston Harbour in the USA. At Communicate 88, I ran into the owner, Alan Wiener, the man behind the Radio New York International project of last year. You may recall that after a short test transmission, the radio ship, which was flying the Honduran flag, was boarded by officials from the US Federal Communications Commission, and the equipment was disabled by government agents. Charges, though, were later dropped. So, where's the Sarah now?
It's now anchored 4 miles off the coast of Long Beach, Long Island, in international waters, awaiting its turn to go on the air.
So you are going to bring Radio New York International back?
We're trying. We're trying really hard. There are some legal obstacles that we still have to overcome because we want to avoid what happened to us last year, which was a kind of a storm the ship, tear everything apart, then return it to us and say, oops, we're sorry. But if we're lucky, in a short span of time, perhaps within 30 days, she'll be on the air broadcasting.
So what have you got in the way of equipment?
Okay, well, she's got a 10-kilowatt medium-wave transmitter, a 1-kilowatt medium-wave backup, a 10-kilowatt FM transmitter, a small 300-watt shortwave, and an experimental 75-watt long-wave transmitter on, which we probably won't be using.
Why the shortwave? I mean, what's the kick for that? Is it simply, let's say, for the hobbyists?
There are a lot of people in the United States that picked up our test transmissions on shortwave, and we feel that it's a good way for people not only throughout the continental United States but other parts of the world to get a chance to hear our free radio broadcast. So that's why the shortwave.
The definition of free radio varies widely. In Britain, many free radio enthusiasts point to the United States as their dream system. They'd like to see small, commercial local stations right across the nation, each playing their own type of music. Alan Wiener, though, argues that many radio stations in the United States have lost most of their individuality.
In your major markets, it has really gotten very homogenized. Stations cost so much money now that when they're bought up, the owners really can't do any serious creative radio, creative communication.
What sort of prices are you talking about?
The average station, either AM or FM, in a major market can go for $25 million or up. I would say that every single radio station in the New York market is owned by a major corporation or some conglomerate. Radio New York International, when we get back on the air, will be the only station serving the metropolitan New York area that's actually run by individuals and not a major, major corporation.
RNI, though, won't be everyone's cup of tea. And if it does stay on the air, will its offbeat programming attract a sizable audience to make it viable? Time will tell. But why is the ship called the Sarah?
That was a promise I made to my wife. She asked me if I would name the ship after her after we purchased it, and I said yes. And came the time to paint the letters on, I wrote the name Sarah.
Okay, assuming those legal problems are sorted out and you can come on the way that you want to, what are you going to hear first?
Okay, the first frequency we will be on is 1620. And we will mainly center our broadcasting over that medium wave channel and see how things go. If things go well and we can expand to other frequencies on a non-interference basis, we will do so.
What sort of response did you get from especially the hobbyist community when you were on, you're offering QSL cards? Did you get a lot of response?
We were kind of overwhelmed. We did give out a mailing address, which is no longer active. We got about 1,000 requests, which we really didn't expect, but people heard the medium wave, and especially the short wave, all over the country.
For 12 hours on Saturday, several hundred enthusiasts sat in the conference hall listening to radio stories. When it came to offshore broadcasting, it was amazing to see the nostalgia that swelled up when recordings and stories of the 1960s and 70s were replayed. Chris Edwards is editor of a magazine called Offshore Radio Echoes, actually printed in northern France. What brings people together to talk about radio shows, some of which left the airwaves 20 years ago?
I think a lot of it probably is the sort of romance of the pirate thing, people being out there at sea, perhaps sort of poking two fingers at the authorities. There's the British thing, I think, really, of going for the underdog, the poor little guy against the big guy. It's basically what a lot of it's about.
So if Caroline was ever legalised, that would be it?
I'm sure it would be, yes. I think the appeal of Caroline basically is it is at sea.
And how many people are involved with this offshore radio business, if you can call it that? I mean, collecting records and the memorabilia that goes with it?
I would think here, probably in Britain anyway, I would guess there's probably 2,000 or 3,000 people, hardcore people, and probably the same, perhaps another 3,000 or 4,000 in Europe.
Notice that despite talk of European integration in 1992, most people in the UK still talk about Britain on the one hand and Europe on the other. The island mentality is as strong as ever. Bode van Dom from Antwerp, Belgium, was another Communicate 88 delegate who'd spent some $400 getting to the convention. What was the attraction?
Well, I've been listening to offshore radio since 1962 and always followed what happened on the offshore scene. To begin with the very first Flemish pirate, Radio Antwerpen, from the ship Eulenspiegel. Then, as a youngster, I listened to the British offshore stations, Radio London, Radio Caroline, and things like that. And afterwards, there was, off the Dutch coast, Radio Veronica. And then into the 70s, we had Radio North Sea and Radio Atlantis and Radio Mi Amigo. And I've always been interested in that kind of radio because I had the impression that friends talked to me. It was not something written on a paper. It was real talk, friend to friend. And, well, I've always listened to it. Then I got involved in some offshore magazines. I worked for some of them. And then... So you get to know some people all over the place. You go to conventions, you buy records. And when I heard that the first offshore convention in the north in England will be held, I took the opportunity to come down or to come up and to see what happened here. That's it.
What about the interest in offshore radio in Belgium and also in northern France too? Now that all the local radio stations have started, has the interest in the offshore era began to disappear?
Well, these days it is disappearing, and for me it's a pity. In the 70s there was a huge demand for offshore radio, and everybody, all the youngsters, listening to it. There was something of the magic of the little man, David, fighting Goliath, the state, the government. But with the uprise of the FM stations in the north of France and in Flanders as well, the youngsters of today listen to FM radio. They have a better signal, a better quality. They have their new beat, their new records. But people of the 40s, in their 40s, they still remember the good old days, as they call it. Some people laugh at us and they say it's team radio. But anyway, today... in Flanders and in the north of France, only a few people listen to offshore radio.
Radio Netherlands with 3.2 million watts of good ideas.
There's a lot more to come from that Blackpool convention over the next few weeks on this programme, and we'll also examine the BBC Radio 88 show at Earl's Court, which opens a 10-day run this coming Saturday in London. Talking of the BBC, this past Sunday saw the start of the BBC's Indian Ocean relay station on the Seychelles. They've also started to relay their signal via a transmitter that belongs to Radio Brass in Brazil. A narrowband telephone circuit is being used as a temporary measure to get the studio signal from London to Brazil, which is why the audio quality is only fair at present. The BBC frequency via Radio Brás is 6185 kHz. 6185, and it runs from 09 to 11 hours UTC in English and 11 to 11.30 hours in Spanish. It's aimed up along the southwestern coast of South America. And talking of relays, my colleague from Radio Austria International's German service is on the line now from Vienna. It's Wolf Harrant. So what's new, Wolf?
Yes, indeed, Jonathan. I'd like to update the comment you made on our program in frequency swapping with Radio Canada International. And to do so, here with me in the studio is Dr. Edgar Sterbens. He's our Director for Coordination and Program Planning by Radio Austria International, and he can tell you what's actually going to happen.
Well, Radio Austria International is close to a shortwave relay agreement with Radio Canada International. Radio Austria International will broadcast some 2 hours a day to North America via the Radio Canada International transmitter site at Sackville. In return, Radio Canada International will get 2 hours a day for early morning broadcasts in English and French, beamed to the Middle East via Radio Austria International facilities at Mosbrunn, south of Vienna in Lower Austria. We're looking forward to iron out all the nitty-gritty points, presumably in November this year, and if we're successful, we should start by the 2nd of April 1989, the date for the clock change from standard to daylight saving time in Northern America, and presumably Radio Canada International will get 2 hours between 3 and 5 UTC, and we will get 2 hours between 5 and 7 UTC.
And how come we choose RCI and how come they choose Radio Austria International as their partner?
Well, we were much interested to reach the western part of North America, particularly the west coast of the United States. And Radio Canada International is interested to broadcast in a better quality to the Middle East.
Right. Well, thank you for that explanation. Wolf, while we've still got you on the line, what's the status regarding next year's European DX Council conference for shortwave listeners? I thought that Vienna was going to host it next year, but I understand there's an update to that too.
Well, yes, we originally planned to host next year's EDXC conference in Vienna, but the development of this year's conference in Antwerp caused us to earnestly reconsider our proposal. You see, the main reason is that EDXC seems to be quite undecided at the time being about the real purpose of these conferences. Some people feel they should be expanded and include the public at large as a kind of international radio days for all those interested in shortwave radio, not only for the access in the strict sense. Others feel the conference should return to the grassroots, talk about pure DXing and nothing else, no sponsors, no posh hotels, no talking about politics, and by politics they mean everything that concerns broadcasting apart from QSLs, sunspot numbers, and time and frequency schedules. Still others are concerned about too many all-dominating broadcasters present and too few real DXs. Well, in my personal opinion, the EDXC should do some soul-searching first. Do they want to act as an umbrella organization of European DX clubs? In that case, they should find out why the club leaders of all people abstained from attending for the past couple of years. And those that were present did not really find anything much substantial to talk about. Or should these EDXC conferences continue to be representative gatherings of broadcasters and listeners? In that case, EDXC must accept that pure DXing is no longer the one and only all-embracing purpose of our hobby. Well, our intention is to officially apply for hosting the EDXC conference in 1990 as a joint venture of Radio Austria International and ADXB, the Austrian DX Club. Until then, EDXC will have ample time to make up its mind and decide. Perhaps it is not too bad after all to pause for a year and probably start an internal discussion within EDXC.
Well, thank you, Wolf.
Media Network, copyright 1988. Human rights preserved.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000.
If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network program. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.